show that looks at Kansas City baseball's past, present, and future.
High fly ball. Motley going back to the track. No outs to go. The Royals have won the 1985 World Series.
Davis comes to the plate. Strike three called. It's over. They've done it. The Royals are World Series champions. The world champion Kansas City Royals.
This is the Kansas City Baseball Vault.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome in to the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn, a Baseball Prospectus affiliate. We took a week off last week, folks, and we delayed the recording by a day because it just seemed, Mike, as you put it to me, completely un-American to record a podcast, even one about baseball, during a Game 7 of a World Series, especially one as meaningful to both organizations involved as this one with the Cubs and the Indians. But we will get to that in a second. First introductions. I, of course, am Jeff Herr. With me, as always, is everyone's Game 7 starter, Michael Engel. Mike, how are you doing on this? I don't even know how to describe the weather. It's kind of like rainy, but it's not really raining. And it's kind of cold, but it's not really cold, but it's not hot. It's like a weird fall day. But
yeah, it was like 70 degrees today on November 3rd, and the Cubs are world champions. I don't know what's happening right now.
That's nothing, right. Spoiler alert.
Nothing makes sense.
If you, for some reason, happen to be living truly under a rock, Cubs did win the World Series in Game 7 in what was a just ridiculously epic Game 7. You know, as good as the Royals-Giants Game 7 was in 2014, you know, that was kind of a different type of game. It wasn't like a back and forth or anything. I mean, you know, it was the Royals tied it at 2-2 for a little bit, and then it was, and then just kind of, it was watching the dominance of Madison Bumgarner and, you know, just the tension of like any one play could decide it. But this game was completely different. You know, there was a lot of action, a lot of things, a lot of poor play, actually. It looked like there was some Game 7 jitters, some errors by both sides. Just some, you know, Rajai Davis made a couple of poor plays in the outfield. Javier Baez made a couple of poor plays in the infield. You know, it was just a lot of things that didn't really go all that. It kind of reminded me of that the Cardinals Rangers series in 2011, you know, that game six, like that was a phenomenal game to watch, but there was a lot of like, I remember Matt Holliday had a couple errors and everyone was down on him on like Twitter and stuff. And there was all the, you know, just like Nelson Cruz and all his issues in the outfield. So just like a poorly played game, but just because it's poorly played doesn't mean it's exciting and it's fun. You know, I'd say poorly played, like relatively speaking, of course, you know,
it wasn't pristine.
Super tight. Exactly. You know, like you saw, I can't think of one off the top of my head, but
there was that wild pitch by Lester, and there was
I'm trying to like of an example of like what would have been a pristine game, you know, off the top of my head. I couldn't.
Well, you know, game 7 in 91 was pretty strong.
How could we forget?
Pretty, yeah, 25 years ago.
But, you know, I mean, the Cubs are World Series champions. So Theo Epstein, I mean, we can start here, and because this may be the most fascinating angle to me. I mean, and I was talking, I have a friend of mine, I mentioned him before on the show, who, you know, congrats to him and all the Chicago Cubs fans, but, you know, he was a fan. I texted him today to say congratulations. And, you know, we were talking about Theo Epstein, and it was just like, we were both saying the same thing. Like, where do you go from here? Like, he's not going to leave the Cubs, obviously, but I mean, just in terms of like a career, I mean, you went and you took the Boston Red Sox, a cursed franchise with an 86-year world championship drought, and you got them to the promised land more than once. And then you go from maybe the most pressure-packed GM job in the sport because of that history of the curse, because of where the large market size, because of everything that went with it, to maybe the second most. And now that you had won with Boston, maybe even now the most that superseded it now as the most pressure-packed GM job in the country. And or in the league. And then he goes and he does it again. within 5 years, he had a direct plan, stuck to it. It worked out perfectly. And now they're world champions. I mean, if you're Theo Epstein, like, I don't, is it possible to be any better or to have any better of a resume as a general manager in in the sport? It's hard to compare, you know, one over the other, but in terms of just looking at baseball, like, I don't know that you could say there's any general manager that could have a better resume. There might be some with, you know, Yankees general managers that have more World Series championships, but I don't know that you look at any and see they're as impressive as Theo Epstein's.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess like the Cleveland Browns or the Detroit Lions.
Yeah, you could switch sports maybe. Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of what it turns, you know, you got to go to those sad sack franchises.
That's what maybe Paul, he could DePodesta, be the, right?
Yeah.
He's the Browns now.
Could be the commissioner of Major League Soccer and bring that into contention with the NFL, or I don't know. It's impressive. I mean, you take, you know, just one, he's an executive who's won 3 World Series. I mean, that's impressive enough, but to do it, you know, and exercise the demons of Boston and Chicago, it's kind of amazing. And I mean, eventually those teams were going to win. Probably, you know, I mean, the Royals eventually.
How many Chicago Cubs fans that were born in 1936 and died 5 years ago, maybe, thought that their whole lives, though? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's all relative, right?
True.
They'll win someday. Well, not for a lot of people.
That was the, wasn't that the Eddie Vedder song, the Someday or something?
Yep.
I think so. Yeah. I mean, you know, maybe there's something to that, but that is a pretty, if nothing else, even if you just look at it and say, hey, it's 3 world championships, that's pretty impressive. But, you know, the added kind of oomph of Boston and Chicago, it's significant. I mean, it's pretty much where he'd be able to work wherever he wants, whenever he wants to. You know, right now, I mean, he's not going to leave the Cubs. It'd be silly to leave the Cubs right now. They're just at the start of what should be a pretty strong run.
I mean, he might win 2 or 3 more.
I very well could. I mean, they won 103 games this year, and you know, they don't really, the main kind of subtractions that they'll have will be like Aroldis Chapman and David Ross. And I was like, well, you can probably get around those, you know, without studying their roster. But you and Chris Bryant, Anthony Rizzo, Baez, Soler, Addison Russell, Wilson Contreras. I mean, all these guys, Ben Zobrist, all these guys that, you know, Lester, you know, there's so many names. There's too many names. It's kind of a super team in a way. It's kind of annoying, and it's probably going to be annoying if they make it to the World Series again next year and win it. So that's, you know, if you're a Cubs fan, be ready for a backlash, probably. It's just kind of what happened with the Red Sox. But, yeah.
Almost instantaneous. I mean, you can see, like, I mean, my feeling like changed. It was like 5 minutes of like, oh, good for the Cubs. And then I'm like, well, damn. Crap. You know, now they're this team. They've got this immense amount of incredible talent. They're really good. And like you talked about Aroldis Chapman, you know, he might leave, but it's like they could afford him if they wanted to, you know, and they can go out and they could afford anybody that they want. And I mean, they're just that, they're another team. They're the Red Sox now. So it's like, you know, I mean, good for you. You got your championship, but get ready, as you said.
Yeah. I mean, there were even people who didn't like the Royals in 2016 because, you know, the Royals had like 3 years of success and people turned sour on them right away, too. And it's like, well, that's nice. Thanks. You know, it's not the same kind of thing. You know, so we'll see. I mean, I mean, generally, I like the Cubs, but, you know, it's Royals first and foremost, and you know, if that means that people don't like the Cubs, I'll deal with that. I'm fine with that. Comfortable.
Yeah, you know. So something that was kind of interesting, you see, there was an interesting stat that's passed around. I haven't like heard this confirmed, but I heard it on the show last night, and we were kind of looking it over. The broadcast last night, and we were right before this show, we were kind of talking it over, and apparently this is the first World Series where no pitcher has gone beyond 6 innings in a game. So we looked it up, because initially I thought I had heard five innings, but I believe it was actually six. So, I mean, we looked it up, and you had, you know, Corey Kluber went six in game one. And would you say John Lester went six in game five?
Yeah. And Arrieta went like 5.2 in a game.
Yep.
But yeah.
Lester went 5.2 in game one.
Yeah. But you're right. It was nobody surpassed six innings, which in this era, and with these kind of teams, you know, Kluber, who has won a Cy Young and is a contender this year, and Arrieta, who won it last year, and Lester, who's always in the mix, and, you know, Kyle Hendricks, who had a fantastic year and led the league, the National League in ERA. None of those guys went more than six innings. Kind of remarkable, exceptional even, for that to happen. Just kind of, you know, that's a surprising stat. One, that it never happened any other time. And two, that it happened with this group and, you know, in a seven-game series, too. You would almost kind of figure that with, you know, these guys going a couple of times, you would have somebody, you know, find their way to 6.2 or seven innings. You know, it doesn't have to be necessarily a complete game, but, you know, to not go past six innings is pretty remarkable and surprising.
It really is. And it's kind of a trend we've noticed over when you look at, even if you just snapshot it to the last 3 years, I mean, you know, I'd have to look back now because I didn't really think about it, but we could think of two concrete examples from the last 2 years, obviously, of a pitcher going beyond six. Obviously, Madison Bumgarner in game one of the 2014 World Series pitched the complete game. And then you had Matt Harvey. So both extremes as the Royals fan, the really bad results of the long outing with Bumgarner, but then the very next year, Matt Harvey in game five going back out for the ninth. And we all know how that turned out. So, but, you know, I'd have to look and see for the Royals how many players they had or how many pitchers they had. So let's see. Game one in 2015 looks like Volquez went six innings and Matt Harvey went six innings. Game two, let's see. This is more just kind of because I'm really curious. Oh, Johnny Cueto went nine innings. Okay.
Oh, yeah,
That complete game. Of course, like that one of the best pitching performances in Royals playoff history, of course. So, but anyway, you know, obviously it's a few more exceptions in the last couple of years, but you know, we see this trend, and you could kind of argue that the Giants started a little bit because they've always had pretty fluid, pretty good bullpens for their playoff runs. And, you know, the Royals really kind of made it an art form last couple of years. And now you see both Cleveland and Chicago making use of that same kind of formula. And I heard Napi Katie on the radio on my way to work today at 8:10 talking about how, you know, he's a little worried that, you know, they're going to look back because of that stat, because this is the year that no pitcher went past six innings because of that stat, that this will be the year that people will look back and say playoff baseball bullpen management truly changed in 2016. And it's because of the Cubs and it's because of Cleveland. And, you know, when it was actually a blueprint that the Royals laid out for their postseason success. And I see his point. Time will tell, I guess. I don't really know. But regardless of whether or not, you know, the Royals will get their due credit, it's certainly obvious that there has been a shift, and the Royals are part of that, whether you want to give them credit for starting the whole thing or not. You know, they're a part of it, and they're a big part because of all the success they've had. So it's kind of interesting to see it that way. And you know, the Cubs and Cleveland, they did it a little bit differently because, you know, the Royals had that murderer's row in 2014 of HDH and all that. And then 2015, it was basically the same thing, just switch out one H for another. And Cleveland and Chicago both Cleveland had a little bit better. You know, they had Andrew Miller and Cody Allen and Brian Shaw.
They're kind of their
yeah, they called him the law firm of Miller, Shaw, and Allen, which I thought was kind of funny, but that's what the broadcast called him. And then you had the Cubs. They didn't really have a reliable bullpen. They just had Aroldis Chapman that they got at midseason, and he was such a horse, and he was so good, and he could go for so long. And I heard that he threw the most pitches of any reliever in postseason World Series history. So, I mean, they basically just rode him, and they had a couple other guys get them what they could.
Yeah.
So it was really, you know, the Indians were a little bit more closer to what the Royals did, but they still rode Andrew Miller much harder than the Royals did pretty much any reliever in the past 2 years. I mean, with the all the extra inning games the Royals played over the last 2 years kind of has skewed things a little bit. So you had, you know, Herrera went 3 innings in the World Series last year at one point and things like that. But those are kind of outliers. You know, they're the Cubs and the Indians were pitching Chapman and Miller for 2+ innings in just a normal 9-inning game. So, I mean, it's kind of interesting to see them take the same idea but have kind of a different approach to it.
Yeah, the crazy thing was, like, you know, just Andrew Miller alone, like, that's if there's like you know, I think as far as changing the way things are used, that might slight, like, Miller's usage may be the one example that kind of sticks out to people, because he was used in whatever situation they needed to get the outs and not necessarily to wait and get the last 3 outs, which is something that a lot of people have advocated for a long time as a way to manage your bullpen, because, you know, your biggest threat may be in the 7th inning. It's not necessarily that you have to wait until the 9th inning to use the guy. And I think it was on FanGraphs or maybe it was ESPN where someone wrote, it's funny how managers find that what they consider a close game happens to coincide now with what the save stat looks for. And, you know, that's how it's kind of developed, is, you know, there's kind of been an incentivization of going for the save and just kind of getting in lockstep of, okay, here, he's my closer. That's, you know, the 9th inning is his inning. Mm-hmm. And Miller was coming in situations that weren't necessarily, you know, he was coming in, you know, in the 5th inning in some cases in the World Series. And he did that throughout the entire playoffs. So that might be the trend that we see a little bit more of, because it's been shown to be effective. The one issue is that, one, not every team has an Andrew Miller. You know, that's one, you have to have a guy who can do it and be that dominant. And you have to have a guy who's willing to do it.
That's part number one.
Right, which that's tough enough. And then they have to be willing to do it in a spot where you aren't going to get the save. You might stop the rally in the 7th inning, but you're probably not going to be in there in the regular season in the middle of June pitching through to the 9th. You're probably going to get 3 outs when you're coming on with like 2 runners on and it's a 1-run lead and you're just trying to protect that. That might be the trend that we see in some cases. So that's kind of the interesting thing for me. I think that what you saw here was that the Indians had, like, really Miller and Allen were the dominant guys. Shaw is, they used him a little more situationally, it seemed like. And they were willing to go with Miller and Allen for extended periods. The Royals really worked on trying to, you know, stick to that 1 inning at a time. And, you know, what you saw, at least in the playoffs, was like, yeah, the Royals bullpen, like the big guys in the back end were covering about a month's worth of innings in half as many games, but they were able to only do that with, you know, 1 inning at a time, maybe a couple of innings. When it came down to, like, you know, game 7 in 2014, Herrera threw a few innings and you know, they really kind of covered. It was Guthrie for 3 innings or 3.2, and then Herrera, and then Davis and then Holland, and that was kind of it. Like, those three covered the rest of the game. You saw those extra innings where last year in game five, it was Herrera going, what, three innings in New York to kind of get it, you know, to hold the Royals in place. You know, it's not like supremely revolutionary, but with the Royals, it seemed a little bit more of the situation called for it versus it being, you know, we're going to try to get through 15 outs and then we're going to Miller and then we're going to Allen. You know, the Royals were more like, okay, we're going to get through this point and then we're going to go to those guys. I mean, one example that I think of is game one of the ALCS where Edinson Volquez has the bases loaded. You could have gone to a reliever then, and he gets out of it.
You and I were there, man. That was tense, dude. That was one of the most tense.
Yeah. That was tough. And so, you know, I think there's kind of a little bit of, you know, where the Royals showed that you don't have to have a dominant starting pitching staff to get through a deep playoff run if you have strong relievers. And this is kind of an extension of that. As far as like playoff bullpen management, where, okay, you've got this huge beastly reliever in Andrew Miller who's pitching, you know, two innings at a time in the middle of the game and basically just acting as a bridge between your closer and your starter and just basically taking a third of the game out of the opposing team's hands. And then you have Chapman, who basically can only pitched really towards the end of the game and pitched basically like you're getting the last outs of the game, go out there and get to it. You know, so it was kind of an extension as far as like the amount that they're used, but not necessarily the same situations. You know, I don't know if we'll see an extension into a regular season, but that's probably going to be the way that people you know try to use their bullpens throughout the playoffs in the future, unless you're Buck Showalter and then you don't bring your best reliever in at all, which is kind of a funny way for the entire playoffs to start when that's like the big story. And now the theme is, you know, relievers all over the place. So, interesting kind of bookends to how it all works out. But, you know, I think it's, you know, it goes into the idea of, you know, times through the order and, you know, in the case of Cleveland, I mean, it was very clear that the Cubs had figured out Corey Kluber because they'd seen him three different times within the span of 10 days. You know, so they had a good idea what he was doing. You know, Hendricks was, you know, not to talk too much about tactical decisions, he was pulled too early last night, I thought. Mm-hmm. You know, then they went to Lester, who kind of tripped over himself in relief, but you know it
did not throw to first base.
I don't know. It was a very interesting series. We'll see how much of this stuff gets used in the regular season. I think it's, you know, not that Bucchetti was saying that it's going to be used that way, but I think a lot of people think, well, maybe people will use this more. I think you'll see it with maybe two or three teams who have a guy who can do it, who's willing to do it. And then you get to the playoffs and all bets are off. You know, you just go crazy and you use guys you need to use to get the outs in the big moments.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you've seen the Royals go about as far as any team can or will go in terms of reliever using how much relievers are used in season. You know, I just don't, and we've seen it come back to bite the Royals even, you know, this season, how they've used them in the past. So it's just not something that I think you just can't operate on a win today, worry about tomorrow later philosophy on a 162 game season. You simply cannot do it. So
there are, you know, some days where Dillon G is going to have to pitch in relief.
Yeah. Some days you just got to eat it, you know, and that's, you know, it just happens. So that's fine. But it might change some philosophies, you know, depending on the game, depending on the situation, you know, bullpen usage will probably go up, but it won't be playoff usage all through 162 games. Something I had a thought about, Mike, tell me if you think this could be a reality, right? We always talk about, you know, somewhat tongue in cheek at times, the, you know, market inefficiencies and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if exploiting the prominence of relievers specifically in season could be almost a new market inefficiency. So let's say you are Chicago White Sox, right?
Okay.
And you maybe they think they'll compete next year, but let's say you agree that you probably won't compete next year. You're going to try and rebuild again or whatever. So, you know, what if you went out as the Chicago White Sox and you signed Aroldis Chapman? You know, I wouldn't, because he's an awful human being, but mm-hmm. for the sake of this argument, he's a free agent.
He's very prominent. Big relief right name now. on the market. So yeah.
You know, it's easy example. But so say you go out and buy and sign Aroldis Chapman to a contract, knowing that maybe he doesn't give you a huge benefit this year, but come midseason, if you're most likely going to be out of it, other teams are going to be in, and they're going to be willing to overpay to get said reliever. Aroldis Chapman netted 4 prospects this season for a half season rental. You know, Andrew Miller got 4, mm-hmm. and he had two and a half years left on his contract. So, I mean, if you signed Aroldis Chapman to a 4-year deal and, you know, you got 4 players for him next season, I mean, you know, I could see that kind of developing into a thing. I mean, relievers, they were already this year, you saw, they were the hottest name. It used to be starters, you know, but as of this year, relievers were the hottest name at the deadline. I mean, part of that might have been the available starters, but,
yeah,
you know, I think next year you might hear a lot of the same. This offseason, you're going to hear a lot of talk about Wade Davis and teams interested in possibly trading the Royals for him. And, you know, the Royals are going to listen to every offer. They always have. I don't think they'll trade him, but, you know, if the right offer came along, maybe, you know, you're going to hear a lot about Chapman because he's going to be a free agent. You know, maybe I think there are some people that thought, even though Andrew Miller has 2 years left on his contract, that he was just going to be a rental, and maybe the Cubs would try and – or the, I'm sorry, the Indians would try and flip him at the end of the year. So there's probably going to be some talk about Andrew Miller and what his future will be. So, you know, relievers are going to be more and more important, especially big, you know, big names like them. And you brought up a really good point that I think is maybe the most interesting dynamic for me with all this new reliever stuff is the idea of the Andrew Miller fireman approach, like you were talking about, where it's not about having your closer for the last 3 outs. Just go out there. We need you now. We need you for the next 2 innings because our starter crapped out at 5 and our bullpen can only, you know, we can go. We got 3 guys, but we got 4 innings left to get. You know, you need to get 2. And you come in and get the 6th and the 7th against the heart of the order, and then somebody else comes in. You know, I mean, that it's definitely more of an old school approach to relievers. And, you know, I think it's definitely really interesting because then you get guys like Andrew Miller and like Luke Hochaver, you know, the former starters who are maybe used to being stretched out a little bit more and used to throwing more pitches in the course of a season. You know, that transition to a reliever then becomes, you know, they always talk about, oh, it's so easy to kind of just air it out for 1 inning. Well, you know, it's not that much harder to air it out for 2, you know? So, yeah. I mean, and especially if you're a former starter, you know, then you can air it out for 2 and not have to worry about a pitch count. You know, if you throw 35 pitches in 2 innings, you know, that's okay. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's definitely not, cause you don't have to get 4 more innings after that. So it's, I think that's going to be the most interesting thing to me to watch is if we're going to see more of a fluid kind of closer position where, you know, would it make sense for Kelvin Herrera to be the Cody Allen role of the true closer? And then you have Wade Davis just come in and get you, maybe he gets you 2 outs, maybe he gets you 6. And depending on the situation, you know, it's I don't know that the Royals will change up all that much because they've got something that works pretty well for them. Mm-hmm. But it'll be interesting to see league wide, you know, if that becomes more of a thing.
I think you might see more guys who come in with, like, say there's 1 out in the 6th and they get 2 outs and then they work the next inning. That I think you might see a little bit more of. you know, during the regular season, it's so much is on, you know, most managers anymore don't use a guy more than, you know, two, maybe they'll push it to 3 days in a row. The real benefit in the playoffs is that you've got, you know, usually three games in a row is the maximum you're going to have. And then you have a travel day. So you've always got a built-in day off within each series. And then if you happen to win a series early, you might get an extra off day or two. So when you're looking at the, you know, regular season where you might go 2 weeks without an off day, that's going to make it difficult to kind of push some of those guys. But, you know, if you've got a bullpen of three guys who could probably close like the Royals have had over the past couple of seasons, you might be able to push one of those guys up and use them a little bit more and leverage them a little bit more in a given game. You know, it might only be something where if they do one more inning a week, you know, you probably get out of your one of your best arms, you know, that's probably 20 more innings a year. And you wouldn't even have to do that. If you've got the guys to do that, you could switch it off. You could have, you know, this guy does it a couple of times and then another guy. If you've got a righty and a lefty, you know, if the lineups work out, you might be able to work it that way. So I think it's more likely that you see that than, you know, really going for the fireman approach. But that requires, you know, bullpen depth. And, you know, we saw, you know, the Royals this year, once Wade Davis was down on the DL for the second time, it didn't seem like they wanted to use him hardly at all, or at least as much. And Herrera was kind of the only really big gun out there. Strom was good, but unproven. Soria was, you know, obviously at the end of the year, not very good. And that was kind of it. Moylan was all right in most cases. And that was about all that you had because Hochaver was hurt. Greg Holland was, you know, not on the team. You know, he was rehabbing pretty much as a free agent. And so you didn't have that kind of depth. And you really kind of saw it where the Royals were not able to stretch guys out quite as much. And even if they did, they were just going to be stretching out guys that, you know, had blemishes and whatnot. But if you had a team that has that kind of depth, I mean, I think you could see a little bit more of that. You know, you'd probably still have the closer, quote unquote, be the closer at the back end, but you might have that setup guy pitch a little bit more in the, you know, to cover the seventh and eighth if it's a particularly tough matchup or close game or whatnot. Or if you have an off day coming up, or, you know, you have your ace starting the next day and you feel like you may not need to use that guy. So it might just be a situational thing to take advantage when you can. I mean, those are my general impressions, I think. I'd like to see the Royals do that because they're probably going to be in the same kind of situation where, you know, they'll probably have a pretty deep bullpen again. If nothing else, Dayton Moore can build a deep bullpen. And they probably won't have, you know, big starters. I mean, you hope that Ventura and Duffy and Kennedy can be guys who can go out and get you six innings any day, but you still got two other spots with Vargas and whomever gets the number five spot, and you're not sure if they're going to be able to do that every time out, and you're probably going to have innings to cover. And if the Royals feel like they're going to play well, they're probably going to need to cover those innings with, you know, some of their best relievers. So it's, you know, that they have potential to do something like that.
And I think that seems pretty reasonable. The idea that, you know, it's not going to be so much everyone replicating what Cleveland did because, I mean, not everyone, like you so deftly mentioned at the beginning of the show, not everyone has Andrew Miller. So it's really hard to do it that way. But, you know, I think what you said is reasonable, that you could maybe expect, okay, go an extra out or two versus, hey, we need you to give us 2 2/3 innings 3 nights a week. You know, that's not realistic, but maybe having a less rigid approach is something that we're going to start to see where everything is just a lot more fluid. So, you know, I think that'll be interesting. I'm kind of looking forward to see, because I've been big on advocating for, you know, just it doesn't seem unreasonable to me that if you can have, you know, it gets a little complicated when you really try and work out all the numbers and everything. But, you know, if you can have five guys that you train to pitch, essentially you're training them to pitch 200 plus innings a year. That's the goal anyway.
Yeah.
There's no reason you can't have, you know, six, seven, eight other guys on your roster that are primed to pitch half that at 100 a year. You know, it gets a little bit more complicated when you start talking about, you know, how much rest you need after how much time you pitch and all that kind of stuff. So it's not exactly apples to apples. You know, there's a little bit more to it than that. But, you know, I think an industrious front office could figure out a way to kind of make it work where you've got relievers pitching more innings, and it's done so intentionally.
Yeah, and it's just using your resources as best you can. I mean, there are situations where Wade Davis doesn't pitch because it's not a closing situation, which just means that you're not using your best reliever at that time, which doesn't make any sense. You know, I mean, I get that you don't want to use that guy, like having them there is kind of a firewall, but it goes back to so many other moments that we've seen from the Royals, from other teams, where you save a guy to get a save that never remains. Like it's, you know, because somebody with a lesser arm gave up the lead. And it just ends up, you know, putting you in a position where now you lose the game and, you know, you didn't do it with your best pitcher on the mound. And, you know, that's the most frustrating thing to watch is when you're just waiting for someone to come out and shut down an inning, and you got to see like your fourth reliever out of the bullpen come out because of a save, or because, you know, managers have been conditioned to think that, you know, that they can only protect the lead, that a lead is the only situation where you want to use your best reliever instead of just keep it tied, you know, just make sure you get those three outs and give yourself a chance to go up and hit again. That's what it comes down to most of the time, is that you've just got to get those outs. And, you know, if you go through and never use your guy, you're probably going to lose because, you know, you're pitching a substandard or, you know, suboptimal reliever in a big situation. And the later a game goes, you know, the more each base runner and each run matters because there's less room to wiggle out of. If you give up one run in the first inning, you've got all the rest of the game to make it up. If you give it up in the top of the 10th, you've only got one shot. So if you've got an ace reliever that you can bring in, get those outs. And I just never understand why managers won't do that. It just, it drives me up the wall most of the time. What the
perplexing
book, quote unquote, says. It's just, ugh.
Yep. It's beholden to archaic principles that, you know, postseason baseball is obviously different than regular season, but it's shown, you know, there is a level of success to be had. So you don't have to operate with your bullpens at the same level, but you could possibly have, you know, you can kind of try and meet in the middle. Like, you may not have as much success as a postseason team, but you can also be a little bit closer to how that bullpen management is used, and maybe you win a few more games that you shouldn't, and you find yourself in a better position.
Yeah, just a more sense of urgency. Just, you know, exactly. You don't have to try to get Wade Davis 120 innings, but if it means you bring him into three or four more games a year, well, those might be three or four more wins a year. And that's pretty big if the difference is an 87-win team and a 91-win team.
Yes.
That absolutely can be the difference between sitting at home all October or at least getting a wild card spot.
Indeed. And with that, I think we'll take our first break. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more Royals focused and talk about some things as we now officially enter the off season. So stick with us and we'll see you back on the other side.
The Kansas City Baseball Vault will be right back after these messages.
We saw two or three different replays. It was a bang bang play at first, yet the replays show rather conclusively that the Royals got a tremendous, gigantic break.
The Vault.
And that was Sinfonia in A Major by Sammartini. It's noted that the third vicar of Dunshire would play that every night before delivering sermons. It's a fine piece of music. It's 10 past the hour here on Vault Public Radio. We wanted to remind you, dear listener, that this week is Pledge Week at the Vault. Your support is vital, and giving to Vault Public Radio is one way to help support your community. And speaking of community, you won't find a better friendly community than the staff at Kelly's Westport Inn. Like public radio, Kelly's is a staple of the community, a standard, an icon, a Kansas City tradition. Fine patrons like yourself have been supporting Kelly's Westport Inn since 1947, when, I'd note, that Randall Kelly poured his first pint. Contribute to Vault Public Radio today, you can get an official VPR tote bag, or you could stop by Kelly's for an affordable pint, the best pizza in town, and a few games of Papa Shot. We're grateful for your support at VPR and for your support at Kelly's Westport Inn. Enjoy the tradition. And now, 4 hours of Best of the Baroque Period, followed by the Amstein Theaters and The Horse You Rode In On, hosted by Joseph Guevara Amherst.
Welcome back into the Kansas City Baseball Vault, brought to you by Kelly's Westport Inn, a Baseball Perspectives affiliate. Thanks for sticking with us through that break there. And now we can talk a little bit more Royals focused here as we officially head into the offseason, as Mike and I are staring at the offseason schedule for the next couple months from MLBTradeRumors.com. But before we really dive into that, one of the things of note that was kind of making the rounds a little bit today is Greg Holland is set for a showcase, within the next week or so. And there's expected to be a decent amount of interest. And, you know, I'm not sure. I don't know what to think about all this, but I do know that, you know, Greg Holland, I see no reason why you wouldn't think Holland could come back and be successful. You know, I mean, we've seen lots of players come back from Tommy John surgery before and be just fine. You know, even guys that are quote unquote max effort like Greg Holland. And, you know, he was so talented before and so good before that even if he comes back at 90% of what he once was, he's still going to be better than 75% of all the other relievers out there. So, I mean, you know, whereas, you know, at the peak of his powers, he was arguably the best reliever in baseball. And so then he just becomes like, oh, you know, in the top 25% of all relievers in baseball. So, I mean, that's okay. You know, it's the question is, of course, if that's going to be the case. But if that is the case, then I think you're justified in having a lot of interest in him. And I expect the Royals to have a lot of interest in him. I expect him to have a lot of interest in coming back to Kansas City. I don't know if he'll get a job, get a deal done. You know, I know that had he not been injured, you know, his salary was, I mean, he would probably be in the, you know, 10 to 12 million range for a year like this year. I'm not sure how much a Tommy John injury, how much that affects salaries. Obviously, you know, no one's going to give him that same kind of money for 2017. After, you know, missing the end of 2015 and all of 2016. So I'm not sure, you know, where that puts him and how that fits into where the Royals want to spend their money in the offseason. But I definitely expect you know, there's going to be a lot of conversations there. And I, for one, would like to have Greg Holland back, because even an injured Greg Holland, and then if they were to pick up the mutual option with Luke Kochever, you know, even both of those players coming off injuries again, even if they're not as effective as they were at the peak of their powers, that still puts them better than most.
Yeah.
And stack that on top of returning Wade Davis and returning Kelvin Herrera and Joaquim Soria, who I don't believe, you know, will have, I'm not going to try and defend Joaquim Soria at this point. Hopefully he will have a better season next year. But, you know, even still, if Joaquim Soria then becomes your fifth option out of the bullpen, you're sitting okay. And the Royals still have, you know, the possibility of trying to go out and re-sign a guy like Peter Moylan. And, you know, depending on what the starting rotation looks like, you know, maybe Matt Strom starts the season in the bullpen. So there's a lot of options the Royals have to continue to have a really strong bullpen. And I think if you can get Greg Holland back, even if he's maybe a little bit more than you want to pay for a reliever coming off Tommy John, I think it sets you up really nicely to have that formula that got you so much success in 2014, 2015.
Yeah, I think if every team is not at that showcase, I don't know why they would skip it, you know, unless they just happen to know something that everybody else doesn't. Because Holland's a multiple-time All-Star. He's, you know, one of the best relievers at his peak. He's going to be, right now he's a year removed from his Tommy John surgery. So by the time you get into, the beginning of the season, it'll be almost a year and a half since. So he should be pretty much out of the woods for any setbacks, should be ready to be full speed ahead. And, you know, I saw on that MLB trade rumors link about that he's in the lower 90s, so by the time you get to spring training, I would figure he'll probably be close to the mid-90s where he usually was in his heyday, just a year ago, a year plus ago, I guess. I don't see why anybody wouldn't try to get him. Now, he might, I don't know what the contract would work out to, but it certainly wouldn't be what your typical market contract would be for a guy like Holland. But it does present, you know, opportunity for, you know, a little bit of risk, you know, because it is Tommy John surgery and not everybody comes back from that, you know, very well. You know, most of the time there's a little bit of a drop off, but, you know, the reward is huge. The reward is you have one of those guys in the back of your bullpen that you can rely on, and maybe you want to work only one inning at a time with him, and that's fair, but he's a guy who's probably going to save you 40 games if you give him the opportunity. And for a team like the Royals, where you have Wade Davis and you have Kelvin Herrera, you don't have to rely on him to be that guy. You can let him get up to speed. You can let him kind of you take your shots with him when you can. He's a really good option for them because, well, one, we've seen what he can do. Two, they probably know his medical situation as well or better than anybody because, one, he was injured while pitching for them. And, you know, I know that they've discussed things with him in the past while he's been a free agent and rehabbing and coming back. So they probably have a leg up on any other team, but maybe not all other teams. So I would say that the Royals should be interested. We'll see what the money would work out to be. And I guess we should see how the showcase goes. But yeah, I mean, he's, you know, to reunite HDH and just maybe shuffle the order would be, I think, just fine for the Royals. I mean, those are three guys that, you know, close a game anytime you needed them to. And if they did get Kochever to return, either through the mutual offer or through another contract, and if Soria can bounce back, that's five guys right there who have been strong relievers, you know, for a large part of their careers. That's the formula we were talking about in the first segment. I mean, that gives you the opportunity to do so many different things, to protect leads, to hold games so that the Royals can, you know, if you hold a team to three runs and give the Royals an opportunity to come back, you know, that's that Matt Harvey game, that's what did it. You know, you get yourself in a position where you can hold the score tied or you can keep a team down so that you can come back and tie it yourself. that's the Royals formula, and Holland would fit in with that as long as everything, you know, looked good. You know, if he's throwing 95 but it's straight and you can't locate it, that's a different matter. But if he looks like he's got the same kind of slider and the same fastball and he's got, you know, his command on him, yeah, I mean, he'll get paid. He'll get paid either by the Royals or somebody else, and I think any bullpen that gets him would be improved immediately.
Absolutely. And I, you know, it kind of brings us to how do we think the Royals are going to attack this offseason? Because, you know, the bullpen still, even as it's constructed today with contract situations being, you know, as we mentioned, you know, Hollins, he wasn't even on the team last year, and Hochaver, if assuming the mutual option isn't picked up, the bullpen still looks pretty decent. You know, I mean, anytime you've got Kelvin Herrera and Wade Davis in the same bullpen, you're looking pretty good.
Right.
But, you know, that's still, from a Royal standpoint of what we've been used to in 2014-15, and, you know, even for most of last year, having one of the top five bullpens in baseball, it's not as good, at least on paper. So, you know, how are they going to attack? I mean, what do you think they're going to target more relievers, or do you think they're going to try and fill some other holes and try and, you know, quote unquote, win the lottery again, like a Peter Moylan or a Scott Frazier or a Ryan Madsen, that type of a thing?
I'm not sure. It's one thing that Dayton's been good at is finding those kind of guys. And I don't think they'd make like a big splash or anything. I don't think they'd be making any kind of a trade. You know, they'll probably look to figure out their fifth starter spot first and then kind of see what happens. But, you know, Hochaver is probably a good guy to go after. You know, Neftali Feliz, I'm just glancing at the free agent list now. You know, he's a guy with a little bit to him that did well. Santiago Casilla didn't have a great year, but he's a name that, you know. So, I mean, they might go for some of these guys. They might just see what their guys in the minor leagues can do. You might start out with some kind of minor league guys or, you know, veteran relievers who sign minor league deals, kind of like Moylan, and see how they start out. And then by the time you get into May or maybe even June, you see if Miguel Almonte is throwing better than he was last year, or maybe Brooks Pounders has come into his own, or maybe somebody like Josh Staumont, who is like lighting it up in triple figures as a starter in the Arizona Fall League. Maybe he's somebody who they come in and they give him a couple of weeks in Omaha and he handles himself well, and they bring him up as this kind of high strikeout, high walk kind of guy, but with a ton of upside to him. Or maybe Kyle Zimmer, who a great tweet from J.J. Cooper from Baseball America tweeted, it was a gif of Charlie Brown running up to try to kick the football. And he wrote that he posted that because he was writing about Kyle Zimmer, which is perfect for Kyle Zimmer. But you never know. I mean, that guy might come up. You know, A.J. Puckett is a guy who was drafted out of college. He might jump up. So they might look to use some of those guys. Matt Strom, obviously, is an option. But, I mean, I would figure they'll probably sign five minor league free agent guys, and probably one of those will probably pan out in the mold of Moylan and, you know, so many others that the Royals have kind of stumbled upon, you know, Ryan Madsen and so on and so forth. That's probably the way that they'll go. You know, you just get a bunch of arms in and see who works out. You know, I think it works. And, you know, I don't think they're going to make a big splash, but, you know, if you're just looking for your fifth and sixth reliever, that's not a bad way to do it. You know, league minimum type guys, maybe $1 million, maybe $2 million if they make the team, that kind of thing, give them some incentive. Yeah, I think there's potential there for the Royals to maybe get some of those hidden gems or kind of resurrect somebody's viability as a reliever. And, you know, if that rounds it out and they do get those other guys like Holland and Hochaver, yeah, you got a pretty nice little bullpen there. So I think that's one element that they go for. You know, starter obviously is another. Not sure. I mean, it's a weird team because they seem to feel comfortable with Paulo Orlando in the outfield. Gerard Dyson is going to be back. They'll have Lorenzo Cain back. They'll have Alex Gordon back. Somewhere in there, Jorge Bonifacio is down the pipe. So if they wanted to trade one of those guys, maybe they could. Hunter Dozier played almost exclusively the outfield towards the end of the year last year. So he might be a guy that if he hits well right away, he could be in there. The only spot that, like left field, they're not going to worry about. First base, obviously. Third base, probably not. I mean, I just don't see that they would be trading Hosmer or Moustakas or Gordon.
Mm-hmm.
If there's anybody who's probably getting traded out of that outfield, it's probably Lorenzo Cain, and that's pretty unlikely. But if they're given an op, you know, if someone comes to them and says, hey, we've got this hotshot second baseman and a 21-year-old starter, well, Royals might do it, but
I'd be curious to see the package that would net a trade for Lorenzo Cain, because I bet it'd be pretty damn good.
Yeah, it probably, and it would have to be if they were willing to trade him away. I think the Royals will listen on anybody, but that doesn't mean you're looking to deal him. So, and they'd be silly to not listen on anybody. If somebody came to them right now and said, "Hey, we want Raul Mondesi or we want Sal Perez." Well, if somebody's going to trade you, their top five guys and their can't-miss guys, we would probably entertain that. I don't know if they're going to make a trade or not. I think more than likely they're going to kind of play with contracts and find a way to maybe sign an extension or two and kind of defer some arbitration money from this year to down the line when Hosmer and Moustakas, and assuming those aren't the extensions, which I would assume they aren't, but you get the payroll down to where you want it this year, and then you shuffle it down to 2018, 2019, 2020, where you're going to have some contracts coming off the books. So I think that's kind of the main thing is they'll probably look to add maybe they'll look aggressively at a right fielder or something, but I think they would have options that they're comfortable with. They probably look at a second baseman. I'm going to assume that Chesler Cuthbert won't play second base because, I mean, look at him. He's not going to be a second baseman. I like Chesler Cuthbert a lot. I think he'll be able to hit. I don't think he's anything but a third baseman at best defensively. I think they're just kind of refining parts. I think a lot of what they'll see is that they're going to get a healthy Lorenzo Cain. They're going to have, hopefully, Alex Gordon healthy and resurgent again. Mike Moustakas will be back. You'll have Eric Hosmer coming off of a career power year. And, Salvador Perez, too, for that matter. So I think they're seeing probably more people returning from injuries as a lot of their upgrades. And, it's like we've talked about before. It's very close to the same kind of team that won the World Series in 2015. So, why mess with it unless you get a really good opportunity to go out and acquire somebody for a reasonable contract or a reasonable package of prospects or players or what have you. There's not much. I just don't get the sense that they feel like they need to shuffle too much right now.
Yeah, no, I think that's pretty accurate, and I think they're banking a lot on, they had a lot of negative regression in 2016. I think they're banking on some positive regression, back towards that mean that they established for 2017. And I think some of that, some of it'll take care of itself because it'll be interesting to see. Mike Moustakas getting back. We still don't know who the real Mike Moustakas is. Is it the 2011 to 2014 Mike Moustakas who got sent down in the middle of a playoff run in May, in 2014? Or is it the guy in 2015 who was an all-world, deserved one of the best third basemen in the league offensively and defensively? Is he that guy, or is he the guy that we have much more evidence to see that he was. You know, who knows? But I think they're anticipating that they get better because he comes back. But that'll be one of the things I'll be looking out for, because, you know, Chester Cuthbert, the season that he had, with the exception of, you know, home runs, the season that he had offensively was better than any that Mike Moustakas had pre-2015. So, you know, I mean, the power is obviously not there like it is with Moose, but just from an offensive standpoint, you know, he has shown that, you know, he can hang with he's a legit major league everyday baseball player. You know, how whether he becomes an all-star like Moustakas did in 2015, who knows? Probably not. But, you know, I would feel, if you told me tomorrow Chester Cuthbert was starting at third base 2017 opening day, I'd be like, let's do this. You know, yeah. It's totally fine. I'm okay with that. So that's a good thing. So, but it raises that question of, you know, is it really going to be that much of an upgrade? So that's what I kind of think is interesting when you look at, especially when you look at, you know, you talk about how they're comfortable with Paolo Orlando, and, you know, Paolo Orlando was one of the bright spots last year.
Yeah.
So if you replace Paolo Orlando, then, you know, he actually had a lot of production offensively, especially in some really hot streaks that he had. So if you were to try and replace Orlando, you know, it's not even so much like, okay, it's just somebody just generally better, but is he better than Orlando was last year? Because if you're looking at year over year progression, a team needs to be better than they were last year. You know, are you really going to get someone that's going to be that much better than Orlando was last year? Because he was pretty good last year in the time that he played. So, I mean, you know, there's a lot of kind of weird little aspects of it that you have to work out. And it's definitely going to be an interesting offseason. And we've kind of talked about it before with you know, how that those first 40 games go. It could go a long way towards, you know, whether we've got some October baseball to look forward to, or to at least hope to look forward to at that point, versus if we're talking about, hey, Hosmer's a New York Yankee and we're rebuilding now.
Right. We get reacquainted with the minor league teams a little bit more again, which we lost track of for a couple of years there.
Indeed. You know, it's going to be an interesting offseason that, it's officially here now. I guess that is it.
Yeah, pretty much.
I mean, you know, by now, like 48 hours, I think. So from the end of the World Series, so like tomorrow ish.
As of this morning, teams began, you know, waving guys. There was a trade earlier, and by the Tigers and Angels, and the teams have to submit qualifying offers by the 7th. So by what is that? Monday. So by Monday at 5 p.m. Eastern, which is actually a day that we're going to be out at Kelly's. If you listened to the show years ago, Troy Royalman Olson will be back in town. We'll be at Kelly's hanging out. But anyway, that'll be the deadline to submit a qualifying offer to players. It's also the deadline for teams to exercise options. And so by this time next week, you know, we'll have an idea of who the Royals offered a qualifying offer to, if, you know, they retain Morales, who has a mutual option, or Volquez, who has a mutual option, or Hochever, who has a mutual option. The only one that we've kind of talked about who might get a qualifying offer would be Morales, and I think he would take that. So we'll know if the Royals have a DH spot to fill or not as well this time next week. And if that means that, you know, they have Cuthbert rotate through there, or Moustakas, or Perez, or whomever, Lorenzo Cain, perhaps, you know, that changes a lot of what the team tries to do over the rest of the offseason. Because then you, if you go in knowing that, you know, then you kind of get a little flexibility. Maybe you feel like that makes your team better because you're not going to be running Sal Perez into the ground, or Lorenzo Cain plays a full season again instead of, you know, having a couple of different bangs and bruises and whatnot. The other interesting thing is to point out that Chester Cuthbert is out of options. So with Moustakas returning from injury, that's kind of interesting to see how that plays out. And that's a big reason why he's playing some second base and instructionals, to see if that's maybe a viable spot for him. But it won't be. But they're trying to see. Dave Lesky on BP Kansas City, he thinks that they're trying to float that out there to entice teams to trade. We'll see. You know, they do have Hunter Dozier, but I consider him more of an outfield prospect than a third base prospect right now. So, I mean, yeah, we'll see. We'll see. This next week will kind of give us some hints, I think, as to what their approach might be. And in the next couple weeks, you might hear about contract extensions or things like that, so that the Royals know what kind of payroll they're operating under and how much money they have to go and pursue some of these guys. So that could be something that comes up over the next couple weeks as well. So it's going to be interesting. And then, like you said, in you know, regard to the way next season might start, you know, that's intriguing too. So the team that the Royals assemble this offseason will be interesting to see how they perform once they get there, because it's going to be a pretty significant first, you know, quarter of the season. And, you know, some of the changes they make this offseason may not even matter by July, or they might be huge in July. We don't know. We'll have to see. It's a really interesting winter, I think, coming up.
Yes, really interesting indeed. And, you know, within the next few weeks, let's see, what does it say here? December 4th through the 8th, with those winter meetings, you know, we all know Dayton Moore loves that the Zach Greinke deal was done. Was that after winter meetings, or was that shortly after? It's usually like shortly after, but yeah, he lays the groundwork.
Yep.
At the winter meetings, and then like a week later,
they plant the seed in the winter meetings, and then about a week later, it sprouts. And,
exactly.
And there's
it
a
sprouts
big
into
move.
Two ALCS MVPs. From a Zach Greinke trade, or into the best closer in baseball in the Will Myers trade. So it's, you know, that'll be the time to really kind of perk your ears up. And the Chiefs are looking pretty good right now, and they'll be going, you know, full swing in early December. But, you know, keep those ears pointed towards the winter meetings in National Harbor, Maryland, apparently. Normally, don't they have them like a tropical place? That sounds awful.
Yeah, Maryland? That sounds like a really crappy place to have to go.
Ugh.
I think it's usually in like Phoenix or San Diego, or I don't know.
Well, that sucks. But anyway, keep your eyes peeled or ears pointed towards that, because that time or shortly after, if there's a big move Dayton Moore is going to make, history has shown us that window is very likely where it will take place.
Yep. And, you know, Wade Davis is maybe a guy they trade. I doubt it, but when you look at Chapman and Kenley Jansen and Mark Melanson really being the only closers on the market, they could pull something off. You know, if they, like, you know, the 22-year-old starter who has 6 years of team control can be pretty enticing. And when you get a clear $10 million off your payroll, you know, that's it could be something. But I don't know. I don't know if that'll happen. But it's something to keep in mind.
Something to keep in mind. Indeed. So with that, I think we'll leave you on this evening, morning, afternoon, night, whatever time you're listening to the show, which you can whenever, because it's a podcast. That's why we do this. We'll leave you, because we'll have plenty to talk about. So we'll know all about the qualifying offers next week, as we will, Mike and I were talking about this before the show, as we will who our nation's next president is, which has absolutely no influence on, I wouldn't say absolutely no, but largely no influence on anything baseball, nor anything on this podcast. Now, I will say, and it's something that we didn't really touch on, the new CBA will be discussed this offseason. Yep. So, and that will be in place before the start of the next. So how does, is it that, because that'll be in place before 2017, but I guess
they're going to continue
free
under,
agency will continue under the old rules, mm-hmm. and then they'll make it so it won't impact it'll be next 2017 offseason. So, you know, there could be some reworking to like the qualifying offer scenario. So guys Eric Hosmer, Mike Moustakas, who knows if at all the Royals will get some sort of compensation, and if they will, what kind it will be. So
I'd be shocked if there wasn't still compensation.
It's got to be. It's a big part of competitive balance. They've got to keep that for sure.
Yeah, I think the main thing is that the players would be looking to eliminate the loss of a draft pick by the signing team, which, you know, that has depressed the value of some of these contracts because, you know, you don't want to dole out 6 years, $120 million, and lose a draft pick.
Right.
You know, so you want to try to make up some of that value.
They should just add a sandwich pick like they do for like the competitive balance stuff or whatever. You know, just give it, you know, if somebody signs one of those free agents, just throw it at the end of the first round, but before the second round starts, you know?
Like for the team that loses the free agent or the team that signs them?
The team that loses them.
Yeah, that's where they get it. They get it in that supplemental round between, technically it's between the first and, but really, you know, you can.
But that's only if it's protected, right? Like if it's past the top 10 or whatever, then they just get your first round pick, right?
The team loses the pick.
The first rounder, but the next pick is just the comp.
It used to be that way. The type A and type B free agents, which you know, you brought up the idea of signing Chapman just with the intent to trade him 3 months later. I mean, that's the kind of, in a way, what the Rays did and the Red Sox did for so long under that system was they would just trade for those guys who are on pace to be type A or type B free agents, regardless of if they needed to use them or not. Like the Rays seemed to have like four relievers that became free agents and they were type A, and so the Rays got like two draft picks for each of them one of those years. It was that year where they had like 10 draft picks in the first three rounds. It's just ridiculous, which is a big reason why they changed it. So, but it's, you know, it's one of those tricks.
Yeah, and I think that might be a possible way to solve the compensation scenario is bringing back the tiering system and, you know, changing it that way. So maybe if you offer a qualifying offer to, say, it's Edinson Volquez, right? And, or Kendrys Morales, and he is a tier B free agent, then say you offer him a qualifying offer. Well, all the rules apply, but then you don't lose your pick and the other team doesn't. You don't lose your pick and the other team doesn't gain a pick. But if it was type A, then maybe everything's the same. So, you know, maybe that could be kind of part of it. And that would eliminate a lot of, cause like, I don't think Irvin Santana after 2013, I don't think he would have been a type A free. I guess I can't remember how they did that, how they determined it. If it was,
yeah, I don't remember. Like that's the thing of like how they determine who lands in what. It almost feels like they would have to do something like, you know, what is it in the NFL, like first round tender, second round tender, or something like that. Isn't that what the system used to be, where you have different tiers of offers you can make to those players who are going to be free agents, and then depending on what, you know, they can either accept it or go to the market, and if they go to the market after rejecting a first round tender, well, then you lose whatever pick. But if it's second round, then you know, it takes it so that you're not losing your first round pick, which is, one, it's the first round pick, but two, it's that draft pool money, which I think a lot of teams anymore is like, that's the thing that they want, because they want to be able to sign that guy in the second round who's holding out, but they want to go over slot for him. So they need that extra $3 million they get from their 20th overall pick or whatever. But if they sign a guy, they don't get that pick and they don't get the draft pool money for it. And so it makes them reluctant to go sign a guy who got a qualifying offer. But if they would only lose their second round pick, well, that's got a lower slot value. So maybe you can just go and, you know, just making the math work and things like that. I don't know. We'll see how it's going to work out. I think all they'll do in the CBA is take away or change what the signing team loses to make it less of a hindrance on actually going after these guys, so that you don't have Kendrys Morales signing in June and, you know, having to start the year. And so that, you know, also so you can balance it so the team doesn't just load up on guys, make offers, and then just load up on draft picks. But compensation, I can't imagine they would let that go.
Yeah, and
it just,
I mean,
kills teams that lose those guys like Hosmer and Moustakas.
For sure. And I think, you know, you could also look at a situation like kind of football where, you know, you've got your restricted and your unrestricted free agents where maybe they kind of alter that Super 2 status where instead of getting to arbitration sooner, maybe you get to free agency a year sooner, but then you get the compensation in that scenario. If you give, if a team gives you a qualifying offer for that final year, theoretically that final sixth year, and, you know, then maybe it is you get the first round. It goes back to that system of, you know, whoever signs it, you swap picks, you get that their pick. And then if, you know, but then if you're another, you know, if you're just a normal free agent, you go, you're not a Super 2 or anything like that, and you just have a, you know, you're unrestricted, if you will, to give the NFL equivalent, then, you know, maybe the rules are different or something. Not saying that's exactly how it has to be, but some sort of a tiering system, I think, could solve some issues.
Yeah, but, I don't know if they're going to overhaul it, but they'll tweak it some. There's going to be a little bit of a difference to it, I'm sure.
Oh, I'm sure. It'll be interesting to see how it affects anything. But, you know, the Major League Baseball Players Association may be the strongest of all players associations. So, you know, things are going really well right now. Baseball players have the highest salaries of all the four professional sports.
And they're guaranteed. And
all guaranteed 100%. And crazy. They just came off this incredible World Series that got really good ratings. So I don't know that there's going to be too many reasons on one side or the other to really try and rock the boat on this. So yeah, I think there'll definitely be some changes that probably need to happen, but overall I think it'll be, you know, mostly uneventful.
Yeah. That's,
but we'll have plenty of time to talk about it.
That's the sense that I get. And, you know, that expires on the current CBA expires on December 1st. I figure they're going to have it announced within the next couple weeks. I mean, that's kind of what I've read on Twitter and other places, that is kind of the speculation. So there's no concern that it's not going to happen. So I think it's safe. Baseball is safe for another year.
Baseball is safe for another year. And with that, we'll leave you. We'll have plenty of time to talk about all these wonderfully juicy tidbits all throughout the off season. And I'm sure there will be plenty more. As the Royals have been dethroned, their reign as the champions was over, or is over.
Lasted a year and a day.
A year and a day. And we already knew as of a week and a half ago that their reign as AL champions, which was 2 years, was over. So a lot of very impressive Royals feats have ended, but all that means is there's more room to start up some more. So we trudge faithfully on into the off season now, as we hope the Royals can get back to where they were in 2015 and where the Cubs were as of yesterday. And yeah, so we'll leave you with that. We'll be here all off season. As we mentioned, we've got the winter meetings in a couple weeks, so hot stove talk is going to really start to heat up here soon, and should be plenty of fun things and scenarios and such to talk about. And we will talk about it all, so stick with us for the rest of the off season. And until next time, thanks for stopping by, and as always, go Royals.
Thank you for listening to the Kansas City Baseball Vault. You can follow us on Twitter at KC Baseball Vault. You can also find us on Baseball Prospectus Kansas City at bpkansascity.com. You can follow BPKC on Twitter at bprokansascity. Also, you can subscribe to the podcast through iTunes, through Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you like. And if you have any questions, comments, or if you just want to say hi, send those emails to kansascitybaseballvault@gmail.com.